Let's turn tonight to Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8. At the end of the lesson, we have been making observations, especially on things such as a miracle that we're looking at tonight. And for probably five or six times, I've said, I'm going to quit soon enough to let you feed back some observations on it. So as we go through the lesson tonight, assuming that we get done by maybe quarter or ten till with the lesson, assuming that, as we go through, see if you can come up with some good observations concerning the miracle we're looking at tonight. And what we're seeing is a tempest stilled. Primary passage, Luke 8, 22 through 25. Parallel passages, Matthew 8, 23 through 27. And Mark 4, 35 through 41. And we will be going back to some of these others because they're going to be necessary to get the full picture. And we start with then the setting. And immediately to get the setting, we need to leave where we just turned, mark it, and go to Mark 4, 35, 36. Because Mark gives an important setting for what happens here, noting two things. Mark 4, 35 and 36. First, Mark chapter 4 and verse 35 gives the chronology, or gives the time. Luke does not give it. Luke simply says, coming down to his account, in chapter 8, verse 22, he simply says, it came about on one of those days. And it leaves us wondering what one of those days. Well, Mark, in his account, is more concerned about the chronology or the time of it. And so Mark 4:35 says, on that day when evening had come. So the time was evening of the day on which the parable of the sower was taught. The parable of the sower, remember the four kinds of ground, the good soil, the thorny soil, the rocky soil. And as he teaches these, and that day, the parable of the sower, on that very evening, he says, let's cross over to the eastern shore. So the setting for the tempest stilled is the evening of the day on which the parable of the sower was taught. Second, and if you move down to Mark 4:36, he says, and leaving the multitude, they took him along with him just as he was in the boat, and other boats were with him. And so the setting involved pertains to the crowd. Is that the Lord had taught multitudes pressing in on the shore, the western shore of Galilee. And now he gets in his boat, and as he begins to sail, part of that crowd gets in boats, and they make it a fleet. So that you have massive crowds, very large crowds. As a matter of fact, the Lord was leaving the western shore simply because the crowds were so big, and they were pressing him, and he was exhausted. Second, coming into the parable, the miracle, is the timing of it. Now, in order to perform a stilling of a squall or a thunderstorm, he had to be on Galilee at the right time. He had to be on the sea or the lake, whichever you would call it, at the right time. Now, had this been the type of thing where, as you know, some weather sets in and it stays and stays and stays. However, you know something about a thunderstorm, and one of the characteristics of the thunderstorm, unless it is a squall line, and it would really even be true there, is that thunderstorms are quick. And again, I need to explain very little of that. Since we're all from the Midwest, you know what it's like to see the cumulus clouds in the afternoon, and they build up into thunderstorms. It thunderstorms, and by 9 o'clock or so, the clouds are gone, and the sky is clear again. So and here was not even a squall line. It was a single weather phenomena coming off of the eastern shore mountains down onto the Sea of Galilee. And these were often brief, where one moment the the Galilee would be motionless and still. Then down comes the rushing winds, the storm comes up, and in a matter of maybe 10, 15 minutes, the whole thing is over with. It can be very, very brief. So you do have an issue of timing. And if the Lord was going to dissipate the storm, He had to be there probably at the most within a 30-minute time frame. So as He teaches the multitudes, gets in the boat, gets out at the right place in Galilee, near the eastern shore, at the right time, and again, we're probably looking within a 30-minute time frame. So the timing, obviously, is important. The second thing about the timing is that on the eastern shore, there was a man in need. Now, we will not do it tonight, but next time we will have him arriving on that shore. And in Luke chapter 8, verse 26, they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when he had come out into the land, he was met by a certain man from the city who was possessed with demons. And that narrative continues clear down, notice, through verse 39. And so Luke gives big space, lots of columns to what's going to happen when he gets over there. And so we'll simply note 8:29, clear down through 39. Some 10 verses, or 26 rather, down through 39, more than 10 verses are going to deal with what happens when he gets on that side of Galilee. The setting, the timing, and now the details. And before going into five aspects of the details, let's simply read through Luke 8 and see what is going to happen in this narrative. We're reading verses 22 through 25. Now it came about on one of those days that he and his disciples got into a boat, and he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake." And they launched out. But as they were sailing along, he fell asleep, and a fierce gale of wind descended upon the lake, and they began to be swamped and to be in danger. And they came to him and woke him up, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And being aroused, he rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. And he said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were fearful and amazed, saying to one another, "Who then is this, that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him?" With that, they're on the eastern shore. So let's break down some of the details into, first, verse 22, the departure. 8, verse 22. And the first thing to ask and answer is when the Lord says, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake," why did he say that? First question. Why? Depart. At all. There are two reasons. One of them is found in Matthew 8, chapter 18, chapter 8, verse 18. And again, we'll move between these parallel accounts a little bit tonight to get the whole picture. Matthew 8 and verse 18. And notice it is in direct response to the crowd that the Lord goes to the other side. And verse 18 of Matthew 8 gives us a little bit of information we don't have otherwise. Now when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to depart to the other side. So notice part of the reason then, why depart, why leave? One, the pressing crowd. And that's further substantiated by Mark's account that even when he left the crowd on the shore, many of them got into boats and they followed him across. The Lord was exhausted with an oppressing crowd. And that is a second, going back to Luke chapter 8, that as he gets in the boat, the rear of the boat, he falls immediately asleep. Pressing crowd, and he was exhausted. He must have been very exhausted because the boat starts to fill up with water and it's tossed all over out of control and he sleeps. So, and I think there are other reasons for that too, but doubtless he was totally exhausted on this particular day. So why depart? Because of that reason. Second, why depart? But again, a little bit of local color. Local color simply means there are certain things in it that just fit that particular circumstances. They're local. They color the narrative. And the local color comes from Mark, because Mark says when he got in the boat, he went to the stern. Got in the boat and immediately, and Mark gives this detail. If you want to look at his account, we'll not turn to it now, but it's in the parallel account. He went to the stern. That obviously would be the what? Front of the boat? Rear of the boat. So he went to the stern, the rear of the boat, and he took a sailor's cushion. That's not unusual in a rowboat, is it? If you're in a rowboat, and the fisherman's going to be sitting there rowing and sitting on that board that goes from one side of the boat to another, he most likely is going to have a pillow to sit on. And so the Lord gets in the boat, and perhaps on the way to the back, he grabs a cushion that a fisherman sat on, plops the cushion down, lies down, and goes to sleep in the rear of the boat. With that, the focus now is on the tempest that rises. The tempest. Chapter 8, verse 23 of Luke. Now, in the description of the tempest in verse 23, the Matthew, Mark, and Luke account both describe the word or the storm with two words. Two words describe this storm. The first one is a word used by Matthew, and Matthew says it was a great storm. That's our translators, a great storm. And you would recognize both of the Greek words that are used here. It was a mega seismos. Great is mega. We have that word, Greek word brought over into megatrends, mega bucks, mega things, and it's simply the Greek word for big, translated here great. The word translated storm is seismos. Seismos means to shake. We have a machine that measures certain kind of shaking. What's it called? A seismograph. It's a measure of how much something shakes. For example, look at Matthew 28 and verse 2. Luke calls the storm, Matthew calls the storm a mega shaking. And Matthew uses the same expression in chapter 28 verse 2, except the thing that shakes is not water, but it's land. And thus in 28:2, you read in Matthew, and behold, a mega seismos, same expression as found in Luke, only here they've called it an earthquake. Okay, if it's an earthquake, then what would be a good translation for great storm? How about matching it? If in Matthew 28 it's a mega seismos called earthquake, why don't we make this a seaquake? I'm not even sure that is a word, but it does register the original very, very, very strongly. And it's been called a severe or a great storm. And it's therefore paralleled with an earthquake is the storm at sea. That's one word that's used. But if you go back to Luke, Luke describes it with another word. And that is in Luke 8, down at verse 23. As they were sailing along, he fell asleep, and a fierce gale of wind. So he calls it a gale. And he uses the Greek word laylaps. I suppose would translate it L-A-I-L-A-P-S. A laylaps. The word laylaps was used in the following ways. Number one, it was a word that could translate what we would have as a tornado, as a whirlwind, or it was used of a squall. And again, living in the Midwest, you have an idea of what a great wind or a tornado can be like. I remember several millennia ago in grade school when one hit in Hickman Mills. Does anyone remember the Hickman Mills? And I was just amazed as a kid. Houses picked up and moved for blocks intact, at least until they hit the ground. Move for blocks, and you couldn't imagine anything that powerful. This is a word that in the Greek language would be appropriate to describe something like that, that would literally pick up something and move it, such as a house for blocks. And that's why in this context we need to use imagination. If you can imagine seeing your neighbor's house, looking out the window and suddenly seeing it, it's gone, lifted from its foundation, you would tend to be a little bit testy sweaty palms or excited, and that's part of the getting into the picture that we need in this particular context. And that's why you cannot study and appreciate the miracles in the New Testament without imagination. If you can't get yourself into the picture and see the panic they had, it's very difficult. Very interesting. I wish I had done a little more work on it when we were there. Remember the raising of the widow's son at Nain? Just happened to come across some of the geographical background on that, and they can establish that Nain was up on a mountain, and the cemetery was down at the foot of the mountain, and there was one road only, and it was very narrow, that connected Nain with the cemetery down at the bottom. And here comes Jesus up the mountain on that narrow trail. And it was the only way up on that narrow trail, and out comes the funeral procession, and they meet, and somebody had to get off the road and let the other party pass. That gives a little dramatic, doesn't it? Here's the Prince of Life meeting head on a one-way type thing where someone's going to... So either the Prince of Life gets out of the way or the funeral gets out of the way. And you can imagine the drama of the whole thing where the group that steps aside and gives way is the funeral party. And it gives the color and the excitement to it that lets you use your imagination. So try to get all quaked up if you can in the context, because this is what's going to happen here. It's going to be a horrible thing. Now, notice again, and this is part of the local color, it says in verse 23 that a fierce gale of wind descended upon the lake. Now, if you know anything about the geography of this area, you know that while Galilee is all pretty much surrounded at least by hills, but when you get over to the eastern shore of Galilee in this particular area of the Gerasenes, you have something more like mountains. And the characteristic of those mountains was the ridges that came down, or here's a hill with a, like you take a knife and carved into it down this. Depressions or what? Trench is a good word. Trenches were coming down those mountains, and it was well known, it's documented in many, many places, that often a fierce wind would just funnel right down those trenches and whip up an enormous storm on Galilee, and that's what happened in that particular area on this particular day. Keep in mind with verse 23 that these men were not novices. They didn't go out and get in something that they hadn't been in before. Well, perhaps in this circumstance they did, but being fishermen, experienced with Galilee, knowing where to go, when to go, reading the sky, knowing what the weather meant, these guys were good at it. And they come in this particular context, and they decide, this one is going to get us. The boat is filling up,
We can't control it. Lord, don't you care that we are going to die? We are going to drown? So this, again, the tempest is very important to recognize and note that they were helpless and they were paralyzed with fear. Two words describe the storm. Now, question. What caused the storm? What caused the storm? And let me give you one answer of what caused the storm. And many commentators will say this. Satan caused the storm. Satan did. Now here is the support for that view. Go to Job 1. Job 1. And I present this because there are not enough interpreters that present it this way. They ought to at least be aware of it. What caused the storm? And the first answer that some propose is Satan did. And they will support it as follows. Chapter 1, the Lord talks to Satan concerning Job. And in verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not pour forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. And the narrative describes what happens. And you come down from verse 19 and notice this is the activity that Satan himself is agitating. And verse 19 says, "Behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people and they died, and I, Job speaks, alone have escaped to tell you." And so they argue, notice the force of Satan attempting to wipe out Job and his family, and he is the one that drove the storm into Job. And verse 19, it is very clear he has a causal relationship to the storm. Does anyone at this point see, however, a flaw in that argument? Yeah, I couldn't hurt Job. But he brought the storm, according to verse 12, under whose permission? So I think that's a little bit weak in that Satan may have a hand in this, but to use this for support, which is Job 1, 12 and 19. And we'll just parenthetically notice, this was under God's permission. So that, yes, did Satan cause it, but no, Satan could not have caused it had not the sovereignty of God had a hand in the whole situation. So I think that's really a little bit weak. The second, and we can go back to Luke for this, it's sort of a argument out of the text and also sort of one from what we know about the area into which he goes, and that is the argument that as he sailed toward Gerasa, and that is where he was going, what was the first thing he encountered at Gerasa? This man with many, many demons. And so, it is true, Gerasa was noted for demonic activity. Now, that being granted, that gives a little plausibility, doesn't it? How would Satan respond to the attempt of the Son of God to go into what he might have regarded as his territory? And so you can see that there could be some credence that the storm came up because Jesus is sailing into the area in which Satan has a stake, and Satan, therefore, through the storm, attacks as he did through Job. There's a third argument that is used. And it is this. It's down at verse 24. "They came to him and woke him, saying, 'Master, Master, we're perishing.' And being aroused, he rebuked the wind and waves." And the argument for those that say Satan is involved here is, doesn't rebuking wind... What do you rebuke inanimate objects? Well, I guess we do sometimes. But... isn't it usually if a rebuke is given, it's toward an animate object? Or do you ever rebuke a doorstop on which you hit your toe in the night on the route to the bathroom? I guess you do. I don't know whether it'd be exactly called a rebuke.
Do you rebuke your computer?
Yes. No. We might say other things to the computer or to the doorpost, but it's not. Is it really likely that in that response we're rebuking something? So rebuke, so it is argued, implies an animate object, not inanimate object. And thus, the argument that it was caused by Satan. Second interpretation is just a little bit different. Like 180 degrees, God did. What caused the storm? Satan did. God did. And the arguments for that would be, he is sovereign even over Satan. And if you want to see satanic activity involved here, Satan can act, ought act independently of the sovereign will of God. Second, I think there's a, remember we went over hermeneutics? It means having good reasons for interpreting the way you do. What in the text argues for you or to you out of this passage that Satan caused this? Let me put it another way. We read through 8:22 through 25. Had I not mentioned Satan, would you have thought of it from these verses? I would say not. And I think that here is the fundamental weakness of that. It's hermeneutical, and it's the weakness of argument from silence. An argument from silence is usually not good. I think it's probably true in any line of study and interpretation. Shouldn't you argue from what is there? Or can you build an argument from what is not there? And the Satan theory, to me, builds an argument on what is not there. There's no remark about Satan, and therefore it may be reading into the text rather than what we ought to do, reading out of the text. And therefore, when you look through that passage, is there not a word, not a hint about Satan? And in order to support the Satan view, what do you have to do with this passage? You got to leave it and go elsewhere. Is that sound interpretation? Well, that's weak. We ought to let the passage say what it says. So I only mention the Satan idea because many very good interpreters will bring that into the picture. But to me, it's better to let the text stand just like it is. Don't try to read into it and simply recognize the general principle that God did in order to give an opportunity to display the power of Jesus. All right, then, the tempest. Now, number three, the outcry. Three, the outcry. And that is 8:24a. And let me begin by saying when in verse 24 the disciples say, Master, Master, we are perishing. And when you read the verse, let me read in to the first thing that they did that was wrong. And they came to him and woke him up. That was wrong. Now, I'm not trying to get pious at this point, because I think we hinted the other night, I would have said, let's wake him up, you know, the first time he saw a little cloud out there on the horizon. Don't let him sleep. It looks like a thunderstorm's coming along, so keep him awake. You know, Peter, rib him every few minutes if he starts to fall off, because we want him to see the build-ups, and we want him to see the lightning. We want him to feel the wind, so don't let him, you know, like someone driving the car, you know, for overnight to get someplace, and you always leave someone up to when they begin to drift off the road, to keep them awake. And frankly, I, you know, with that possibility of the storm, I would have said, let's put a designated driver aboard this thing, and you, every time he begins to droop, give him a punch and say, wake up. In a critical way, but I am willing to write it and then show why I say it. The disciples were wrong.
and waking him up. Now, looking at the context, why can I say that? Well, we can say that because when they do that, what does he say in verse 25? Where is your faith? They woke him up. And Matthew, by the way, is going to say, he said, where is your faith before he stilled the storm? That's Matthew puts it in a chronological order. Here it appears as though he quiets, the storm comes on. They wake him up, first event. He rebukes the storm. It settles. And then as it settles, he says, where was your faith? But notice he doesn't say, where was your faith? He says, where is your faith? And Matthew gives the account. And the account as given by Matthew is, let's look at that. Matthew 8:25. Matthew gives a little touch of chronology here that helps. Matthew chapter 8, verse 25. Verse 25 says, 24 to get the context. Behold, there arose a great storm in the sea, so that the boat was covered with waves, and he himself was asleep. That's the first event. Second event, they came to him and woke him. That's the second. Saying, save us, Lord, we are perishing. And when he had been awakened, he said to them, why are you so timid, you men of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds. So notice with his time sequential words like then, that Matthew puts the order. So the order then of what happened is sleep, storm, awakening, rebuke, two rebukes, the where is your faith remark, and then the miracle. So notice the Lord responds immediately, you woke me up. And the implication that you shouldn't do that. And the reason you shouldn't have done that is because it's contrary to faith. Now going back to Luke, why did their outcry and asking the Lord to awake, why did the cry reveal lack of faith? How did the waking of Jesus reveal lack of faith? It's very clear that it did, but how did it? Very clear that it was lack of faith because Jesus says it was. But how? It's what we want to look at. Number one, because it displayed no hope. It was an evidence that they felt there was no hope. Looking at the Luke account, coming down to their cry, Master, Master, we are perishing. He does not say we might. They do not say we are going to. It is not future tense. It is not a subjunctive mood. Maybe we will. We are present tense in the process of perishing. In other words, it's a plain statement that, Lord, we're going down. The second indication and thing to note there is that verb, we are perishing, is passive voice, meaning we're being acted upon by the storm and we're going to drown. It displayed no hope. Second, it displayed panic. What in their statement shows intensity of feeling and panic? Notice the double Master. Master. We're perishing. So the double master says that we're panicking. Third, let's not make display it again. It indicated very clearly that Jesus was not concerned about them. They said so, not here in Luke. But they said, we are drowning and you don't even care. Now just to see that, notice it in Mark 4:38. They did not believe the Lord had their interest at heart. They thought he would let them drown, and they're not timid in any way about saying so. Chapter 4, verse 38. He himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they awoke him and said to him, Teacher, don't you care that we are perishing? And so notice they call into question the Lord's care for them. And therefore you can go back to Luke and say, all of this comes together, the lack of hope, the panic, the lack of trust in his care about them, all justifies the words that Jesus spoke, which is, where is your faith? That's the outcry. Fourth, the miracle. The miracle. 8:24b. And being aroused, he rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. Two things about that. First, the verb, rebuked, asserts his power over the forces of nature. Two, is there anything unusual about the way this storm ends? It says he rebuked the wind and the waves. Please note, two things, the wind and the waves. And they stopped. Normally it would be how? First the wind, then the waves. If you've got a bucket of water and you're just churning it for all you're worth, that would be the wind. And it's splashing all over the place and it's churning in the bucket and you immediately stop churning. What happens to the bucket? Does it transition from being churned to smooth? No, the waves still continue to churn. But as is the case in the miracles of Jesus, they're undebatable, undeniable, and they always end up, remember, in the healing miracles, there's no recuperation. Peter's mother-in-law was very, very ill. The Lord rebukes that the fever goes away and she's up and serving. Where was the recuperation period that you would expect? Where was the weakness that would follow this? It wasn't there. And in this particular context, the way the text reads, it had to be a dramatic thing to see. All these waves are coming up and the wind stops and the waves stop immediately. Just as, although with that they fall down and immediately transition to a motionless sea and they stopped. And it became calm. And that's all presented in the Greek text as a series of events that were just bang, 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 like that. He rebuked it. The waves settled. The water quieted. Just bang, 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 like that. That's the nature of the miracle. Both wind and wave stopped simultaneously. Stopped together. The admonition is next. Fifth, the admonition. Eight, 25a. He said to them, where is your faith? I looked for it in our hymn book, but we don't have it. Do you ever remember singing the hymn, Master, the Tempest is Raging? Remember this. Okay. Let me quote a stanza from it. No, one of the stanzas reads, no waters can swallow the ship where lies the master of ocean and earth and skies. And they did not grasp that fact in this particular context. What is the most typical encouragement that the Lord gives us? In the Old Testament, the most typical form of encouragement for God's people
Can you think what it might be? The most typical form of encouragement that the Lord's people are offered. Four words. I am, anyone finish it? With you. Can you wrap up Psalm 23 any better than that? The Lord, my shepherd, I shall not want, and so forth and so forth. And the whole thing is premised on I am with you. And the thrust here, had they read over from their Old Testaments, would have been just exactly like the hymn reads. No water can swallow the ship where lies the master of ocean and earth and skies. And they missed that. Sixth, the effect. Sixth, the effect. 8:25b. Now, the effect of it stated down in verse 25 is one of the most unusual endings to a miracle anywhere in the life of Christ. And you see what's unusual about it. Notice it ends asking a question without answering it. Because the way it ends, they were fearful and amazed, saying to one another, and this is the end, who then is this, that he commands even the winds and the waters, and they obey him? And where is your answer? Notice it is not answered, and we'll make an observation about that in just a moment. At first I thought this was trite, but the more you think of it, the truer it becomes. Mothers can dry tears. Repairman can fix the washer. Surgeons can remove diseased tissue. But it takes deity to change the weather. And can you imagine going outside and rebuke a thunderstorm? Go up to Antioch Center, get in the parking lot, and start rebuking the heat, rebuking the wind. And that is so unusual that if you do that long enough, you will probably be forcefully removed and taken probably down to Missouri Western Mental, or perhaps Tri-County if you're north of the river, because anybody that rebukes weather is crazy, just plain crazy. And consequently, in this context, the Lord's power over nature. Now, why does the narrative end with a question unanswered? Why no answer to the question? Who then is this? And I would say it's a part of Luke's technique so that everyone who reads is forced to answer for himself. Everyone who reads must, one, give his own answer. Who then is this man? And he doesn't answer it. You answer it. Every man must give his own answer, and giving the answer, profess or confess his own faith and sing his own doxology as to who this man is. Okay, observations. And I said I would ask for some from you. We may be able to get them, but not yet, because I want to get mine in first. Observations just means, now let's go back and read it, and what do you see? And remember, an observation has to be provable. You're not reading anything into it. You have to see what is there. And is it not interesting that the Lord was awakened not by what? The storm. But by an outcry of human need. So let's see if we can formulate that into a sentence. An outcry of human distress
even if it was one that lacked faith. An outcry of human distress awakened the Lord's attention. The outcry of human distress awakened Jesus' attention when a violent storm could not. Now, when you make an observation, you might want to do something else. You might want to let your mind start at Genesis and read through. Is there anything else that would kind of... That's a wonderful idea. The Lord is more attuned to their distress than He was to a storm. Can someone think of another instance in the context of the cross when He was hanging there being crucified in agony? And He looks to John and He says, John, behold your mother, Mary. Take care of her. Now what's that saying? In the midst of personal danger, the need of Mary is more prominent than anything else. And it shows the sensitivity to the Lord to that sort of thing. And I bet you if you think through other passages, you could add a whole bunch of references to this. Second. Jesus is truly man and truly God. You say, well, now where do you get that in the context? Well, that's not difficult. He was truly man is exhibited in that He entered the boat exhausted. He entered the boat exhausted. Fell asleep. He was truly man. He was also truly God. He rebuked forces of nature and they obeyed. We shouldn't make any mistake. Men could curse the weather all they want, but it would do no good. So notice again, He was tired and He fell asleep. He was man. He rebuked the forces of nature and they obeyed. He was truly God. Third observation. The ability of the Lord to sleep through a storm of this magnitude revealed two things. It revealed not only His trust, but also, and very similar to the last one, it also showed His exhaustion in the labor in which He worked. Ability to sleep through the storm revealed not only His trust, but His exhaustion. Four. Can you think of anybody else who might be interesting to compare with Jesus asleep in the boat and the boat is about to sink? Who else went to sleep in a boat? Jonah. And so we might make a little comparison. Jonah slept. Jesus slept. Jonah slept because of a dead conscience. Jesus slept because of a pure conscience. The presence of each one designates something different. The presence of Jonah created peril. The presence of Jesus assured safety. Now, that's all of my observations. Does anyone have another? And when I say all of the observations, that doesn't mean all that there are.
books. I'm sure we could sit down and think about it a little bit more and make some other. Anyone have any parallel? Now, don't feel timid about this. Remember, I've got the jump on you. I've had all week, all day long, some 12 hours a day to think about these things. So it takes a little. All right, I'll go to Dave. Dave. Okay, let me repeat it. Despite our lack of faith, which they had, the Lord still protected the disciples, didn't they? They thought they were going to drown. They apparently, from all circumstances, were going to drown. They didn't have great big faith, and the Lord said, well, okay, you didn't have any faith, drown, you rascals. He provided anyway, and that's encouraging, isn't it? Okay, second. Okay, God's protection of us does not rest on our own merit. What's the word for that? God saves by grace. Okay, Dave Collins.
Do you take this calling them men of little faith to mean they were afraid they were going to die, or Jesus expected them to be able to rebuke the winds themselves?
I hadn't thought of that. The question was this... that he expected them to be able to do something, or the other option would be little faith with regard to him. I would tend to go with the latter because of Luke's addition that the thing their minds go to is what? What manner of man is this? And so their focus of their attention was not on themselves. The focus to which Luke brings us is what it made them ask about him. So I think we could conclude that the way they came out of this whole thing, they certainly didn't interpret it that we should have done something. The net impact on them was to perceive we are dazzled by this man. Okay, parallel of Peter walking on water and the Lord, and he takes his eyes off him and begins to sink. That could well be. I would have, again, a little difficulty with that in the history of the disciples, you come to a point where he gives them powers. He sends out the 70, remember, to do these miraculous things. And I just make an observation. They had not been given that power yet. If that's the case, then we would again be arguing from silence. Or arguing from one passage chronologically backwards into another. Okay?
Coming down through this passage, it seems that the disciples not necessarily lack faith. I mean, they believe that if they woke the Lord, that he would save them. That's faith in somebody, right? Not leading up to this point, the Lord had provided miracles to establish his deity and to build their faith.
Okay.
And then here, the question is, when it gets down to being rebuked by the Lord, and they say, who is this that he commands even the water and the wind to obey him? Now, It doesn't fit together.
Well, I think the observation I'd make on that is that how real they were. Did these men have evidence that the Lord had miracle working power?
Well, he doesn't.
They'd seen it, hadn't they? They'd seen it. I just make one observation. Don't we learn slow? And isn't that often true? We are so dense when it comes to appreciate the person of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I haven't created the impression saying they did the wrong thing, that I'm up here passing judgment on them. As I said, I'd have the life jacket on before they did. I mean, you got to have something to back, just in case the Lord doesn't come through. You got to have a backup. Lance alive. Don't ask for committal. Yes. Sure.
The other thing is when they said, when he asked the question, where is your faith? Well, yes, we know later on. He's the author of the future of our faith. So their faith is right there in the book with them.
Sure.
But they didn't know it that much.
They did not recognize it. Yeah, and I think the observation that these men are so human. And yet, don't you sometimes, are we just self-righteous? Do you back off and say, you dumb guys? I mean, he raises someone from the dead and you don't see who he is yet. And we tend to think we would have certainly had better. I doubt it. Floyd.
Yeah, Ryer's comment on that, who then is this? He said that with the acknowledgement that he is the greater
one. That's a good point, isn't it? Who then is this shows that they were amazed and that their previous view of him must have been deficient and that he must be something more than what we have understood him to be. That's a good observation. Well, Dr. Ryrie, I'm going to comment on his observations. He does okay once in a while. Okay, thank you. Yes, Nancy.
Could the lack of faith be tied to the fact that in verse 22 he says, let's go to the other side of the lake?
In other words, going to the other side of the lake perhaps has implied that we're going to get from point A to point B. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? Let's go to the other side of the lake says we're going to get to the other side of the lake. Who else used that line of thinking? Remember in Acts where Paul was told, you're going to get to Rome? And he got great strength in his ship. In fact, that was the very point there, wasn't it? In Acts 27, that the ship can't sink because God has told me I'm going to get to Rome. Why don't you guys call me more often on the phone? I do a lot less study. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word and your truth in Christ's name. Amen.